Hi there. This is Juliet Landau. And this is Drusilla. You're listening to Monsters, Madness, and Magic.
All right, folks. Welcome to the Monsters, Madness, and Magic podcast. I'm your host, Justin, here with a quick word before we dive in. Now, in this episode, I chat with actor Juliet Landau about cultivating her childhood creativity, her directorial debut, A Place Among the Dead, Drusilla, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and more. As always, thanks for listening, and if you'd like to help the show grow, please leave us a review wherever you listen to podcasts. Anyway, without further ado, here you go.
Greetings, boils and ghouls. This is your comrade, the Crypt Keeper here, reporting dead from the Sanctuary of the Strange. Tonight's macabre myth is a fright-filled feature, one overflowing with monsters, madness, and magic.
All right, Juliet, take us back in time. You're a youngster. Are you a book reader, fort builder, troublemaker, or all of the above?
I was a book reader and a secret clubhouse finder.
Oh, now that's interesting. Never heard that one before.
So in terms of, I was an avid reader and I loved Charlotte Bronte. I think Jane Eyre was my favorite, one of my faves. So definitely loved the Bronte sisters and read things like the Hunchback of Notre Dame. I'm still an avid reader. I'm reading Donna Tartt's Pulitzer Prize winning novel, The Goldfinch. In the midst of that, as far as Clubhouse Finder, I grew up for a lot of my childhood was in England. I lived in London. I had a friend named Diane Cannon, like the actress, but not the actress. and we were in Hyde Park and we found this old amazing tree that was hollowed out and had this opening. And so we could crawl inside it. And it was just this open space. And we thought, oh my God, this is perfect. This is a perfect secret clubhouse. We'll come to Hyde Park. We'll have our secret meetings. And we decided to build chairs for it. We went to the lumber store and we bought wood planks. And this is third grade. So We didn't understand how a chair actually works and needs support. So we figured out how to affix it to like one plank and two, but it of course would not support the thing. So we gave up on that part of the project. And then we would have these meetings in the tree, but then we found out that the reason it was hollow, one day we went there and it had paint around it and they were actually gonna cut it down because it had a disease. And that's why it was actually so hollow and kind of amazing. And so then we couldn't use that space anymore. And so we then found this secret crawlway in the house that I was living in. And we sort of had our meetings there. But then this story gets even odder because Diane all of a sudden vanished in the middle of the night. She wasn't in school anymore. And I went to the principal and said, what's happening? And it turned out a lot of my friends in London, their parents worked at the embassy and they were actually CIA kids. And so she literally vanished in the middle of the night. They couldn't tell me where she was. They thought it was possibly in India. I had to have contact with her. I actually had to write to a P.O. box, this mysterious P.O. box, which it then would get forwarded to her. And I literally did that a bunch of times and then never heard from her again. So it was a really, really wild whole thing with my clubhouse partner.
That is cool. That's almost like a Nancy Drew type story.
It sounds like that, right?
Man, so you said you grew up in England. When did you guys make the jump to the States?
Well, I was there for third, fourth, fifth, and sixth grade. So I was here first, and then spent a lot of my formative years in London, and then moved back. And we actually moved back and forth. Mm. So I was there for a couple years, and came back. Then there. Always feel like London is really a big part of my heart and my home.
I mean, obviously, you know, your dad being who he was, did you guys go to the stage a lot early when you were young?
Well, the thing that's so amazing about England is that the arts are subsidized. So, yes, the theater still to this day, you know, the theater and museums, you know, the architecture is embedded in everyday life and in the culture. And so I definitely have always loved going to the theater and still do. And actually met one of my really dear friends probably about 10 years ago in line for the less expensive release tickets in the afternoon that you can get that often can, at the time, I think they were like £5 or something, and at the National Theater. And we were waiting in line together and struck up a conversation, and we're really, really good friends to this day.
When you think back to formative films and TV shows that you grew up on, what comes to mind?
Well, when I was growing up, actually, there were really a lot of terrible shows that I watched. I don't know about you, but and I don't know if you've seen them in reruns, but like, you know, the original Charlie's Angels and The Love Boat and Fantasy Island and Bewitched, like they were not the greatest, you know, narrative pieces of art. But so I definitely grew up with those shows, but I also, you know, got like Taxi, which was an incredible show, and really the characters were so interesting. As far as movies, Saturday Night Fever was definitely a big movie. You know, other TV shows like All in the Family, which was a really trailblazing show. But later, I really got into seeing them in retrospect, not at the time, but movies like Godfather, obviously Godfather 1 and 2, Dog Day Afternoon, On the Waterfront. I remember seeing Sophie's Choice and it being, you know, making a huge impact, and all of the Italian neo-realist films like Shoeshine. Have you ever seen Shoeshine?
I have not.
Oh my gosh, it's an incredible movie. And there's a movie called The Children Are Watching, Germany War Zero. All of those films, they're so emotional and just beautifully told.
When it comes to your own acting journey, do you have an aha, eureka moment you can point to? Maybe a specific play or performance you saw where you thought, you know, that's for me, I'd like to give that a try one day.
You know, I was a dancer first. I was a ballerina and I danced professionally. And at a certain point, I started taking acting classes, and I really loved having a verbal exchange with people and having, you know, talking about conceptual ideas and then using my dance background for a component of the character, the physicality of a character, but also going broader. Because I think I always approached being a dancer like an actress. It was very much about telling a story or communicating the emotion of each piece or each scene or each part of the ballet. And so I immediately had this kind of aha or eureka or kismet moment in terms of loving the community and collaborative element of the theater. And as a dancer, you definitely are collaborating, working, but you do spend a lot of time on your own and working on your own. And even in dance classes where, you know, you're sort of pushing yourself even if it's communal, there's a certain amount of it that's very isolating. And I love it. Like, my soul was a dancer, but I started to get this voracious appetite for plays and for written material. And for the very first class that I took was actually an improvisation class with an actor named Avery Schreiber, who a lot of people know from, he did the Doritos commercials where he had like big curly hair and he like had a big Doritos campaign. But he was a phenomenal actor, a phenomenal talent, and he taught Viola Spolin theater games and improvisation. And for me, coming from a dance background, to wait to get to text and written material and to work from a sort of physical and very intuitive place was a great jumping off point for me. And I just loved it. I loved it so much, and just felt like all my creative juices were, you know, started going.
Have you done much improv since those days?
I've done a lot of theater, and I haven't. I mean, it's funny when my film was released, A Place Among the Dead, last year in October 13th, Friday the 13th. And I was so humbled because we just won an unprecedented amount of awards. We only submitted to 21 film festivals, and we not only got into every single one of those 21, but we swept the awards at every single one with all the major categories. So I think we had like 12 best feature of the festival, 9 best actress for me, 6 best director, like tons of audience choice. Like, it was unbelievable. And so I started doing these award announcement videos in different characters, and we ended up putting it on as one of the Blu-ray extras. And in those, each of those characters, I ended up improvising a lot. And our last one we did, I did Orson Welles and sort of did our tally and everything. And so, yeah, in those I ended up improvising, and they were a lot of fun to shoot.
So, Juliet, before we get too far into your career, something I do like to ask everyone is, what scared you as a kid?
Wow. You know, it's funny. We have a project that we're working on, a documentary series, and Tim Burton said something that really resonated with me. He said, when we interviewed him, he said, "I was never scared by monster movies. I was more scared by real life." And I think I was that person. I grew up, our film is about this, and, you know, it wasn't a happy household, and both of my parents had a narcissistic personality disorder. And so I think that real life was daunting, but creativity was always a place to go and to get to play. So I think I was quite afraid of a lot of things. And I think as an adult, I was also afraid of a lot of things until I kind of got a handle on what my upbringing was, and things started to make sense. And then I became more fearless. I've always been fearless as a performer, but I think just, you know, in terms of understanding why I felt, you know, so much worry and concern.
Right. Now, would you say that your parents were encouraged your pursuit of acting?
I'd say, you know, it's interesting because in most households, you know, be a lawyer, be a doctor. You know, in our house, definitely creativity was a part of our lives, and it was, you know, what was talked about and what was valued. But I think, you know, they were very concerned with their own themselves and their own fame. And so I don't think they actually really would wanted me to necessarily, you know, it's that thing like never outshine the master, like don't, you know, yeah, don't stay in your lane kind of thing. But, you know, so it was a mixed messaging and a double-edged sword, because on one hand, it was like, you know, because you are when you're dealing with people that are narcissistic, you're a reflection of them. And so they want you to do well, but not too well, you know? So, you know, so it was a mixed bag, but definitely, I definitely inherited or absorbed a joy of the arts and of creativity.
Well said. Very first time on stage, and did it go off smoothly?
So let me think. Very first time on stage. I'm trying to think of what it was. Oh, yeah. So, yes, I actually was. So I was going to go and dance with a company in New York. And I had been taking acting classes, and we ended up doing what was called a showcase, but it wasn't really a showcase because we ran for 9 weeks. So it wasn't like one night that we were doing. But I remember I was actually doing, a number of people were doing scenes, and I had picked a scene from an Irwin Shaw short story called Girls in Their Summer Dresses. And we were working on it, and a casting director saw came to one of the performances and asked me if I would want to meet with agents. And I said, well, I'm moving to New York, but and I'm gonna dance with this company, and I've you know we've it's all set, but yeah, I might as well go on the meeting. And so I went on the meeting to an agent that she really liked, and her name was Cynthia, and we had a fantastic sort of stream of consciousness, great conversation. And she was like, I'd love to represent you. And I said, well, okay, that's amazing. I'm planning to move to New York, so I'm not quite sure what to do. And she said, well, why don't I just send you out on a couple auditions? When are you planning to leave? I said, in 2 months' time. She's like, okay, let me just send you out, and then we'll see what happens. The very first audition she sent me on was for a play, which is not usual in Los Angeles, and it was Wendy Wasserstein's Uncommon Women and Others, and I got the job. And so I was like, okay. And so I talked about it with Cynthia, and I said, you know what? Why don't I do the play? I talked to the company in New York. They said, yeah, you can do the play and come later. So I did the play. We ran, I think it was for 8 weeks. I got seen in that play and asked to audition for another play, which was called The Pushcart Peddlers. And it was Murray Siskel. He wrote the famous play Love, and he co-wrote Tootsie, the movie with Dustin Hoffman. It was a wonderful play that I got asked and ended up doing. And it had a musical number in it. It had all this stuff, and it was really fun. So again, I talked to the company in New York, and I said, can I do the play and then come? And they said, yes. And then I got seen in that play, and wildly, Murray Siskel was actually going to be putting on an Equity production in Orange County, which is outside of Los Angeles, of a new play that he wrote. He wanted to workshop it and then bring it to New York and bring it to Broadway. And it was all about his childhood, and it was a musical. And so I went and I auditioned for the play. And I met Murray at the audition, and he literally like jumped up on stage. He hugged me. He said he offered me the part. I called my mom from the theater, and I said, "Oh, I got the part." And she said, "Oh, honey, you misunderstood. You didn't get the part. They don't tell you at the audition. What exactly did Murray say?" I said, "Well, he jumped on stage and he hugged me and he said, you have the part." She said, oh, okay. So I ended up again with the New York and all the same thing, and I ended up doing that play. And so there was a certain point where a momentum was happening. I was getting these extraordinary roles and opportunities and having a ball doing them. And the New York dance company kept getting pushed back and pushed back and pushed back. And then, obviously, I took this path and started thinking also about just the nature of, not that actresses have the most longevity in terms of our business in comparison to actors, but more than than ballet dancers.
So at any time, even early on or now, did you ever have to overcome stage fright? Is this something you have ever dealt with?
I haven't really knock knock had so much stage fright. I think, as I was saying earlier, I had to overcome life fright more than and all other kinds of frights. One of the things that's been interesting with all of the discussions we've been having with the film, because my husband and I co-produced and co-wrote the movie, and we both come from this background. He also was raised in a similar environment, and we wanted to use our experience and make a searingly personal movie, but really just as a device to provoke a broader conversation and a wide dialogue. And that's just happened in spades. And we have this group of people that have named themselves the A Place Among the Deadheads, like the Grateful Dead. And so, like the Grateful Dead, they come to the A Place Among like the Deadheads. They are Deadheads. Come to every, they came to every single screening event. They flew to festivals, and we did this on purpose. Our release plan was an extended period of interactive screening events online as well as live to build the prestige and the conversation. And, you know, we've had all these experts like come on board and be championing and on the journey with us, like Dr. Romani, who's the premier expert on narcissistic personality disorder, and she's a psychologist. We had Dr. Catherine Barrett, who teaches forensic psychology at USC. We had Wendy Blanco, who's the head of trauma recovery services at Peace Over Violence, which is an incredible charity. We had Sylvia Lancaster, who started the Sophie Lancaster Foundation, which is another incredible charity. And what's been amazing is just so many people saying they've had aha moments seeing the movie and going, oh my gosh, that's what I've experienced, whether it be in the family or whether it be in a relationship or in a friendship or in a work situation or, you know, all across the board. And the thing about when you're raised in that environment is it does engender a sense of real insecurity and that, you know, that something's wrong with you. And so talking to everybody is just, it's been such a unbelievable and powerful and profound experience to help people with tools of how to combat some of the negative thinking and stuff that goes along with that. Have you experienced narcissism in your life? Have you ever had that?
Yeah, definitely. I've had some issues with parents, probably just like a lot of people have. Yeah, definitely that had those issues and still does to this day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's so prevalent. I mean, that's the thing. And I think for, you know, one of the reasons we wanted to make the movie and talk about it is because society sort of gaslights you further than you've already been gaslit by saying, how dare you talk about this, especially within the family. And it's so important to shed light on things and say, you know, and also to say that there's options. Like for me, and again, it depends. Every person has to make the choices that work best for them, and anything that is healthy is valid. For me, deciding, and my husband, for both of us deciding to have no contact with our families really enabled our lives to bloom. And, you know, you should be able to say that that is a healthy and viable option without being told, you know, that that's terrible and you're a bad person for taking care of yourself. So, yeah, but thank you for sharing that, because I know
it's... Thank you for asking.
Yeah, absolutely.
While you were on stage, what were your personal favorite roles early on, and how did you transition early on from stage to screen?
Oh, cool. Okay. Well, three of my favorites I did later, and because I always, you know, have gone back to doing stage within stuff. And so I would say Blanche in A Streetcar Named Desire. I think it's one of the best roles ever written. It was pretty heavy to work on, but there is actually a lot of humor in the play as well. But it was funny. I remember saying to Dev, like, why am I feeling so bad? And he's like, because you are many times a week being sort of driven, undervalued, driven insane, carted off, raped, and then carted off to the mental institution. But I would say that it's such a beautiful play and a beautiful part. I also loved Roberta in Danny in the Deep Blue Sea, which is a John Patrick Shanley play. And we ended up running for over 6 months in Los Angeles, which is almost unheard of. We were supposed to run for 6 weeks, but we were sold out. We got all the like rave reviews and critics pick, Los Angeles Times, everything. Like, it was an amazing experience. We had so many audience members that would just come back and come back and come back. It's a really incredible play. It's actually called Danny in the Deep Blue Sea, an Apache Dance. And it's definitely intense and a roller coaster ride, but again, has a lot of humor as well. And it's a very redemptive story. And it sort of is, ultimately, the play is kind of like, no matter what you come from, you know, there's possibility for a better way. And then I think my third favorite play would be Henny in Clifford Odette's Awake and Sing. I got to do that at the Pittsburgh Public Theater, which was a beautiful equity house in Pittsburgh. And so I was there for about 2.5 months, and it's a Depression era drama that was just an incredible experience.
Over my years interviewing actors, I've sort of gathered that each actor has a a method unique to themselves. And, you know, to us laymen, the non-actors, we hear the term method acting gets thrown around and there's all kind of mumbo jumbo that goes with it. But what is your method? What's your personal method?
Well, first of all, I'm curious when you said that, because I've been listening to so many of your interviews, and what made you so interested in talking? Like, I'm fascinated by in talking to actors, and what is it that ignited you to want to have these discussions?
I love movies, obviously. I love film. I love television. And to us the normal people who I try to represent asking you guys questions, that the people who don't act, the fans, it seems fantastical almost. And I just try to demystify it a bit for myself, I guess, like how it's done. Or it just seems, I guess, to folks like myself who don't act, it just seems impossible, because I always had a huge problem with public speaking and such.
So but that's cool. Interesting. Except, but now you do this.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Right?
See, but I get away with it because while more people listen, at the time it's just me and you right now, you know. I can deal with that.
You also have such an incredible voice.
Thank
like you're the timbre of your voice and all of that. Like, it's really amazing. So it's good that you have found this calling.
Thank you.
Absolutely. That's interesting. So if you're one-on-one, it's easier for you than if it's a crowd.
Yeah, I can talk to anybody one-on-one.
Mm-hmm.
But if we get five or six people watching us, I start sweating.
Has it gotten any better?
Yeah, it's gotten a lot better. Yeah, definitely. Even just doing this show from episode one to now we're 250 plus episodes. Yeah, I'm a lot more chill.
That makes sense. It's interesting how sort of practicing stuff, because, you know, I think actors sometimes are of two ilks, either, which I think I'm in the first camp, which is like, I've always been a shy person, but I'm not shy when I'm acting. I'm kind of will go to all ends of exploration as an actor. But in general, I have always been a somewhat shy person, but I had to get over that. And by doing it, like you're saying with your podcast, by doing things like going into rooms and auditioning, or going and having to do press, or talking to a lot of people, or even recently, at one of the film festivals, they asked me to deliver the keynote speech, and it was 20 minutes on stage alone. And that I wonder if I should be doing this. And then it ended up being an incredible experience. But it's like pushing past those comfort zones and finding like, oh, okay, your way into being able to do those things. But, and then I think that there's the actors that are sort of like really kind of showy in the, like, are always kind of on and aren't at all shy. But I think I've, in my travels through this vocation and working with people, I kind of see people in either of those camps in terms of general nature, you know. And for me, by the way, in directing actors recently, you know, whatever works for each person is great. And, you know, what you're doing as a director is obviously finding a way to bring everybody's work into one zone. Like, we ended up having 2 weeks of rehearsal, which was amazing. And for everybody from one line to the biggest part, so that we all were in a world together and everybody knew what they were doing, so that it saved a lot of time when we were shooting. But I was really influenced by a woman named Susan Peretz, and I am a member of the Actor Studio. And Susan, I feel like, was such an incredible mentor, person, talent. She was really a gift in my life. She's passed away, but she was a formidable actress. She was in, I think I mentioned, Dog Day Afternoon is a movie that I really loved. And Susan played Al Pacino's wife in that movie. She played, directed by Sidney Lumet, and many other things as well. And I feel like whenever I go to set or go to a theater, because I'm always, when I'm doing a play, I'm usually the first one there. I like to go when it's quiet. I like, you know, set my props, do whatever, but then have some time where I, you know, just get into the zone of the character and do the work that I need to do, so that each, you know, that it flies. But whenever I get to the theater or set or anything, I feel like I bring Susan with me. Like, there's a piece of me and my outlook on how I work that's so connected to her, and I am forever grateful.
It's funny that you mentioned the term getting in the zone, because I spoke with one of your Buffy co-stars, Armin Shimerman.
Yes.
Armin, well, obviously, you know, he's big in the stage realm, and he said that there's only been once or twice in his career that he's considered himself to be, quote unquote, in the zone on stage, and he cannot remember the performance at all. Not the scene changes or anything. He just remembers, I did this play this night, you know, it was this role, but I don't remember actually doing it. You ever had an experience like that?
That's phenomenal. I love Armin, by the way. Armin and Kitty are dear friends of ours, and he's such a brilliant actor. And he also teaches Shakespeare. He teaches avidly as well. It's funny, I think a lot of people have described it almost like a healthy heroin addiction. You're always chasing that particular fluid flowing high that you don't always get, but that when you do, there is something about it that is where just one thing leads to the next, to the next, to the next in such an organic way. It's always the pursuit of that. And you know, when it happens, it's really golden. I think for a lot of actors, because I've coached a lot of actors as well, or a few actors that I've coached that are so talented. And I think a lot of it comes down to relaxation. And when you're really in a state of relaxation, because even if a character is highly agitated or highly upset, the actor themselves has to be relaxed to access all of that. And, you know, you look at actors like Marlon Brando, or you look at, you know, Meryl Streep, or, you know, and Sean Penn, or, you know, there's just like name so many actors where that fluidity, I think, comes out of a real base of relaxation. And there's nothing like that feeling. And so I don't know if I've completely obliterated like what Armin has described, but I think, I mean, the worst thing is to be a helicopter critic. Like you're, you know, you need to be involved enough in your choices that your head is not judging what you're doing when you're doing it. You know, you don't need the editor or the critic while you're working. You can look later and go, this worked and this works better and all of that stuff. Or for me, when I'm working on, you know, either, you know, a recurring role or something where you're, you know, you can watch dailies and assess with that. But I would say it does feel almost like, you know, I don't know, have you ever had, this is a negative thing, but it's like that in a positive way. Have you ever had a car accident or something where it feels protracted and almost like everything goes into slight slow motion?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's almost like that and yet not, but it's like that.
More fun.
Yeah, more fun, much more fun and much more, you know, open feeling. But I think it's a little bit almost like that feeling of weaving your way through something that and all of those. Because I read something once. I was actually doing some research on that phenomenon for a role. And I read that part of the reason we experience some of those events when it's fight or flight in slow motion is because our brains record every little detail that's happening so that we can think if there's a way to save our own existence, our lives. So we're recording all of these things. And so in daily life, we actually do take in all of those kind of details, but we discard them because we don't think we'll necessarily need them. But because we're having so much almost right on our brains so that to help us, it ends up feeling like, because there's so much detail and so much information, it ends up feeling protracted in like slow motion. So anyway, I thought that was really interesting.
Curious, have you worked with Armin since the Buffy days?
Armin and I are both in BioShock, the video game.
Yes. But I should have known that. Yep.
But we're not in the booth together. So we didn't actually, we got to overlap like coming and going, but we didn't get to work together. And then we have, gosh, it feels like we have, but I don't think we have. We have to fix that.
You do. You should be on the stage together soon.
Yes. And we've seen a lot of his productions on stage, his wife Kitty as well, and then also his directorial efforts on stage and vice versa. They've come to see everything that I'm doing on stage or that my husband and I are producing together as well. And so, yeah, that would be really fun.
I have a very brief, cool Armin story. So when Armin and I were talking, I don't know if you could see or if you've seen the logo to the podcast of the wizard-looking guy.
Yes.
So Armin has written these novels on Dr. John Dee, which is a Queen Elizabeth's court magician. He said, you know, Justin, your logo reminds me a lot of John Dee. And I said, well, it kind of is based on John Dee. So we started talking about John Dee, and I showed him this book that my wife got me, which is The Complete Mystical Records of Dr. John Dee. And it's a pretty expensive, huge collection anyway. So he started asking me some questions that he couldn't find about John Dee. Long story short, we had a research project together for his book, and I contacted the John Dee Research Center in England, and they went through their records that were not scanned online to find the information he was looking for. So we got that info for his book and it figured out.
I love that. That is amazing. Yeah. Oh my gosh.
That was very cool.
What a wild connection too, to have that, and then that's unbelievable.
Pretty dang cool. Well, we've already been dancing around Buffy here, Juliet. So when it comes to Drusilla, what do you recall about the audition, and was it a typical experience in retrospect?
Well, what was interesting about Buffy is I never actually auditioned. Oh. I had pages, and I thought I was going to audition, and it said like character could be English or American. And I went in for a meeting, and it was Joss Whedon, Gail Berman, one of the producers, David Greenwalt, one of the writers and producers, Marcia Shulman, who was the head of casting at Fox, 20th Century Fox. And we proceeded to have the most wonderful stream of consciousness discussion, ping-ponging ideas. I think I did a little bit of Drusilla in the room. I think I said, oh, she has to be English. And they said, yes, if we can find a Spike who can either is English or can do an English accent, that would be perfect. And I think I sort of wafted up to the ceiling and started talking to it as Drew at one point. And they said, oh my God, that's it. And I left. I had a similar experience with Tim Burton, but I left, and before I had even gotten to my car in the parking lot on the lot, my phone rang and my agent said, you have the role. And I said, what? I haven't left yet. And they said, yeah, no, you have the role. And I said, oh my gosh, that's amazing. I had the best time, but I had no idea. And then they asked me, they wanted to pair me with the final choices for Spike. Mm. And the moment that James Marsters came in, we just had an incredible acting chemistry. It really was like a dance. All this stuff happened in his audition that ended up making it into the show. We had that moment where our first episode, we're talking to this character that's called the Anointed One. And instead of talking to him, we sort of were looking at each other and we rested our heads like we might kiss. And then eventually we sort of turned out like, oh yeah, we're talking to him. And we ended up doing that, when he was cast when we shot, and they ended up using it as one of the main promos. They had our heads, they had us turning out, and they had the voiceover say, evil has a few new faces. And then it said, talked about Sunnydale and Buffy. And so we were like, oh, that's so cool. It came out of this acting moment. And James has also an extensive theater background. And so we worked very fluidly together. In, I think our second season was our first season. The second season was our first season on the show. And we would get the scripts then about a week in advance. As the show went on, it got tighter and tighter because of, everybody was behind. But so we would get together and rehearse. We'd come up with a lot of blocking. They really liked it and used it. So we figured we were, had known each other for 200 years. We should get pretty familiar.
Yeah.
And so it was not usual. I mean, it was a different experience in that it was just all kind of fast and furious in a certain way. But then there was enough time after I was cast to do the work, to put all the work into the character.
Were you aware of the show itself before you went in to do the work?
Yes. And that was one of the things that I had said to Joss. I said, it's high school as a nightmare, like the perfect analogy. I mean, and he said, nobody ever really has a follow-up question to that when I'm doing press, because most people can relate to that experience is not being, except for the few that were the homecoming queen or whatever. Most people didn't think that teenage years of high school were were lovely. And so, and I had seen the Clea DuVall episode where she becomes the invisible, she feels invisible and she literally becomes invisible. And so I was talking about that and how, you know, using the paranormal and using vampires with this, you know, to pull this analogy to the extremes was just so, so powerful. But what was interesting is the show hadn't just the moment I actually left my audition after hanging up with my agent, I did a few errands and I stopped at the market and Sarah was on TV Guide for the first time. And I thought, wow, that's pretty awesome. Mm-hmm. This show is you know, it's in this moment where I think more and more people are going to glean or are cotton to it.
So just speaking on Drusilla for a minute, unfortunately, I have not been able to listen to the Buffyverse audio drama yet, but it just released last year. Can you just tell us a bit about the project and how you guys got things rolling again?
Yeah, well, Amber, who plays Tara. Well, I call her, it's Tara,
right,
because
right.
Drusilla's accent, I call her Tara. So when I'm in character. So she and Chris Golden co-wrote and co-produced, and they actually almost a couple years ago reached out to me and said, would you be interested in doing this? We're you know, talking with Audible and Disney about doing it, and or at least Audible at that point. And then I said, yes, absolutely, from what they were talking about. And then obviously it took some time to be brought to fruition. And it was so much fun for me in terms of stepping back into Drusilla. You know, it's an alternate universe and Drusilla is the big bad. Mm. And she's always been such a delicious character, but now she was driving the action and not an appendage or being subservient in any way. And so that was a really interesting arc for Drusilla.
This is definitely an earlier part of your career, Juliet, but I have to ask just because I was a huge fan. It was one episode, but you did work on Millennium with Lance Henriksen. What was that experience like, if you recall it?
Yes. By the way, do you know Troy Foreman?
The name doesn't ring a bell off the top of my head.
He is a huge Millennium aficionado, and he's made a number of documentaries about Millennium and that are really good. And Chris Carter and Lance you might, I feel like if you like Millennium, you would like them, and you and Troy would just get on like gangbusters.
What's his name again?
So his name is Troy Foreman.
Gotcha. I'm writing it down.
Maybe you should have him on your show and you guys can talk about Millennium.
Consider it done.
He'd love that. it was, by the way, it was, we got to work with Lance again in our film, A Place Among the Dead. And Lance is just such a brilliant talent. And he came back to work with us yet again in our documentary series that we're making now. And we have, he's such a raconteur, and he can tell, I mean, the stories that he tells in our documentary, I mean, we could basically use the entire interview without, you know, editing anything out, and people would be riveted. Like, it's just unbelievable. The thing that was interesting in for Millennium is my character was pregnant and she gets kidnapped and they induce labor in a pool of water and they steal my baby and then they dump me outside my house and then we go through all of these machinations and it's really traumatic and then eventually I do get my baby back. But it was quite an extraordinary arc, and it was interesting because when we were working on it, there was one particular scene that I kept bumping against when I had been cast. I kept thinking, well, I've kind of played this scene already, so what's different about the scene? What's different? What I need to do something different. It needs to move from where we were. And it was really interesting because in the rehearsal, which very often with television shows, the rehearsal is more of a blocking or camera rehearsal, blocking meaning where everybody's moving rather than actual acting. But we did rehearse, and within the rehearsal with Lance in that scene, we discovered what was different than the other scene, and it became very evident. And it was a wonderful experience that it was like, oh, in the process of sort of getting in there and rolling our sleeves up, we found that just in time, because then we were shooting it. But it was wonderful. But there was also a crazy thing, because they had induced labor in this sort of jacuzzi-like temple. Well, it was like a temple setting, but it was big, this thing. And it was not, we were shooting in winter, so it was freezing. And then they wanted to shoot the sequence where I am dumped outside my house, and it's a whole cliffhanger. Is she dead or is she alive? And they said, oh, you know, the dress will look really good if it's wet because of the blood and the stuff, it'll be the same color and whatever. So I was in a wet dress on concrete in the one of the coldest winters that they ever have had, shooting this sequence where I'm so glad I didn't get pneumonia. It was insane. I was shaking so uncontrollably badly that I had to try to be still between action and cut, because otherwise it would ruin the, if she dead, if I'm like vibrating, you know. And so we kept doing it, and we had to, for there were issues and whatever. And so it took really long. And I my first movie was actually in Colorado in the winter, in the snow, in wardrobe, where everybody else was bundled up, and my character, because of the nature of it, was not. I was in like a little flimsy top and like riding pants and leather boots as opposed to snow boots. That was cold. This was a level that was so nuts because of being wet, and it was crazy. But the scene worked. You wouldn't know that I was, I looked blue, the lips were blue. So it actually looked like, is she dead? And that was a crazy moment on that shoot.
Well, speaking of the dead, your directorial debut, Place Among the Dead. I wanted to ask, was directing always on your artistic bucket list, so to speak? And do you think being an actor for so long helps you behind the chair when it comes to directing actors?
Yes and yes. Absolutely. I think spending so much time on sets, and you see what works really well, you see what doesn't work really well, you see, what engenders people to bring their best work, what inspires people to collaborate. The whole point of that's wonderful is that you have a vision, and a very clear vision, but then you hire all these talented people to elevate that vision, to bring you things to surprise you, to bring you things that take your vision to another level, that actually execute your vision in ways that you hadn't necessarily anticipated, and that make it better and make it alive and make it thrive. And so I was so excited, and I have directed two shorts before this, but they were documentary subjects. So to get to do a narrative piece and to work with all of the departments in that regard, and work with my husband, because we co-wrote it, we co-produced it, and we also raised the financing, and we're wearing many hats together, and we bring different strengths, because his background, he was a stills photographer and is a stills photographer. He's also a DP, and he brought all of that visual element, and I tend to come from a performance-driven element, and we augment each other's strengths in such a wonderful, wonderful way. And so because it's such a we had a real mission with the movie, we both have, we come from very different backgrounds in terms of geographically and culturally and even socioeconomically, but the experience of being raised by narcissists is so much the same. I mean, there comes a point in every time that we, talk to audiences where people say, wow, whether it's a spouse, an ex-spouse, a partner, an ex-partner, a boss, a coworker, a friend, a family member, family members, or our world leaders, it's like we are describing the exact same person.
Yeah.
Because these traits are so much the same. And that's one of the things that's, if once you know it, you can recognize it, and then you can decide. Much like we use the vampire metaphor in the film, because we felt like it was the perfect metaphor for the ultimate, you know, narcissist. It's a being that drains all for its own needs. It's vampires don't change. They stay exactly the same. Narcissists don't change. Vampires can't see themselves in a mirror, can't see their reflection. Narcissists have zero ability to self-reflect. I mean, there's so many reasons that we thought that it was a good analogy. But once you see it, you can decide, am I like with the vampire, am I going to invite that into my life? I may not have invited, if it's from family, I might not have invited that, the original source of this, into my life, although I've been primed from that experience to invite others of this nature into my life, you know. So in essence, it's a cautionary tale. And so, yes, I think all of that, you know, prior experience was really helpful. And I've gotten to work with just, you know, amazing directors like Tim Burton on Ed Wood, and saw, you know, when he created an environment where it was open and focused, but so creative, and, you know, there was a joy in creativity, and, you know, wanted to mirror those experiences that I felt like birthed work that I've been proud of, or that I enjoyed being a part of.
Well said. Juliet, so acting or directing, stage, screen, or booth, what have you, doesn't matter. All your projects throughout the years, which would you consider the most challenging? Is there just one that you could pick that you lost the most sleep over?
Well, I think I would probably say our film, not because, I mean, it also was the most rewarding, but I think we did something I would never encourage another filmmaker to do. We raised 3/4 of the budget, and we thought, why wait? Why not shoot 3/4 of a movie? And then you're laughing. You are laughing. Yes, it was not a brilliant idea. And then we thought, okay, well, you know, we'll shoot 3/4 of a movie, and then we'll raise the rest of the money. And then what ensued was a lot of sleepless nights that, oh my gosh, what if we don't raise the rest of the money, and we've taken money from people, and so they can't recoup their investment because we haven't made a complete movie. Why did we not wait till we hit the full budget? Why, you know, this was, and so we had many a sleepless night and saying, what have we done? And, you know, and then we did raise the money, and we did end up completing the film. And, you know, and I think any independent filmmaker would say that, you know, much like remodeling a house or dealing with, you know, work, if you're having work done on your house, it takes, you know, twice as long as you anticipate. It takes, you know, twice as much money. Like, there's so many things. We actually had an incredible line producer. His name was Ashley Friedman. He's since retired. He was a locations manager as well. So he did location. He found all the locations for like The Usual Suspects and all these incredible movies. And he also with us helped us find locations as well as line producing. And he was to the penny. But my husband likes to say that every project dies on the operating table at least 2 times. And when you are the parties responsible for it, you're like, oh my God, is it going to revive? You know, is it going to revive? And you have those, you know, dreadful moments. We also did do an incredible job of scheduling, and because of our rehearsal period that we never went over, we made our days. We did everything that way really well. And we even worked with Ashley on a few things. He said, oh, you know, we could put more scenes on this day, but we on purpose scheduled the really emotional scenes to have some breathing room so the actors could really go places and take, you know, not because, you know, I think you'd say like a lot of actors, a pet peeve would be that in shooting television or shooting independent film, that sometimes people say, oh, we've got it, and then we're moving on. And then later in the day you go, oh, I figured out, you know, what really needed to be in that scene. And all the actors said, you know, we never had that on this film because we all were so immersed in it and knew what we were doing. And so, you know, it was like each take was a rehearsal rather than it being, you know, having the pressure of it, of that, because everybody was sort of in, as Armin said, in a zone, you know?
Right, right. Well, Juliet, not going to keep you all afternoon here, just to wind down with these last couple questions. Best acting advice you've received, and who gave it to you?
Oh, gosh. Let me see. You know, I think I have to bring up Susan Peretz again, who there were so many gems from her. And I did get the moment before she died to thank her for everything, and which was meant so much to me to get to tell her all of that. But I don't know that I can think of one thing. I might have to come back to that and see if I can come up with a pearl of wisdom. But I think, especially with film acting, a lot, you know, if you think it, you'll see it. You know, there's it, and I think it's really about creating the circumstances and then showing up for the ride and seeing where it takes you.
I'll throw one out there for actors. Remember your lines.
But, you know, and when something's well written, the lines just go in. That's what's really interesting. When there, it's not well written, it sometimes takes a little more work. Because I always find when something is, you know, when I was working on, you know, Streetcar or Danny or any of the plays that I mentioned, the lines sort of fly in. And even if you're doing an entire play, which seems like, you know, masses and masses, when it's really well written, it's it, there's something like the play supports you in this way, or the movie or the television show or the voiceover script. You know, when it's well written, it actually is much easier with dialogue.
So, Juliet, I like to ask everyone this question. Have you ever had an experience you would consider supernatural or paranormal?
You know, I haven't, actually. Have you?
Oh, I say maybe, but anything that I could say would be, you know, like teenage, what was that kind of deal? Maybe I saw a shadow, or maybe it was my imagination, so I don't know. Possibly.
What do you think you saw, possibly, or heard?
My friends and I were really big into going into old graveyards and such, and doing the whole ghost hunting thing. And it was the sun was going down, and we were around a specific gravestone. And I turned to look back at our cars. I don't know why. I just looked back at our cars, and I swear that I saw someone standing behind my car and kind of like just peeking around like this. And then when I looked back, they immediately ducked back behind the car, to the point where we all went over there, and there was nobody over there. It's just a little spooky happening.
Wow. And did it feel like spook, like scary?
Yeah. We were all kind of, you know, shaken up and like, well, I think that's enough for the evening.
And did you all see it?
Yeah, it was a couple of us. There was maybe like six or seven of us there, and I would say three or four of us saw it, because when I turned around and they saw me looking, a couple of them looked too.
Wow.
So I don't know.
You know, we shot in a New Orleans graveyard for our documentary series that we're making, and our costume designer for both, you know, a number of our projects, she actually gave us this gray soap that was supposed to ward off the spirits. And we just thought, okay, we're going to use it. Like, we haven't experienced anything like this, but we're still going to use it just to be safe, because you know, and New Orleans is a really interesting place in terms of all of that. And my husband's actually had a kind of psychic moment, if you want to. He had a dear friend that died in a very violent way, burned in a Jeep, and he woke up the moment it happened and said, this is before I knew him, but he said, Amy's gone. And he then got the phone call about a half hour later. And, you know, so that was pretty wild. And from a deep sleep, he just was like, I know that something's happened to Amy.
That's intense. So just to put a bow on everything here, Juliet, what's on the horizon for you that you can share without getting in trouble?
Okay. Well, I am currently recurring again as Rita Tedesco on Bosch Legacy. The first time around, I was on Bosch. And so I am shooting that now. And there's another very cool project that I am going to be allowed to announce in May. So I can't talk about that yet. And then a third one is releasing the beginning of June. And we're going to be launching at Monsterpalooza and announcing there. So I'm not allowed to yet talk about that. But it's been a little bit like, this may be before your time, but there was a movie with Sally Field called Sybil, where she played multiple. Yeah, so I've been feeling a bit like that with these three characters at once in my head. And then the other thing is people can watch A Place Among the Dead now. They can stream it on Amazon Prime, Google Play, YouTube Movies, Tubi. The Blu-ray with nearly 5 hours of bonus extras is available on Amazon Prime, Best Buy, Barnes & Noble, Walmart, 40 other online retailers, and also some signed versions are available on my website, so if people want to check that out. So yeah, that's what's going on.
Awesome.
I went to school in North Carolina.
Wow, whereabouts?
North Carolina School of the Arts, Winston-Salem.
Wow, that is crazy. My dad used to live in Winston-Salem.
You're kidding.
No. That's
oh my gosh.
When I used to go visit him, that's where he lived.
Wow. That's wild. Small world. Wow. All right.
All righty. Thank you, ma'am. I appreciate you a lot. Big fan.
Aw, thank you. Thank you. It was amazing. The time flew. Well, and I'm so glad, and thank you for your patience. I know it's been sort of mad actually getting this in the can, so I'm glad we finally got to do it.
Hey, it's over. We did it, and I appreciate you.
Yay. All right. Thanks. All right. Well, keep me. I'll get you what do you need, basically?
Any images you want. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I'll send you some images. When do you need those by?
I'll probably post this by the end of March, so you got time.
Cool. Okay. Perfect. Just if for any reason, I'm going to put it in, so I just send it to you so I remember, but let me just put it in my calendar, or I won't remember anything because that's my life. So let me do this. I'm here. I'm just going to say send. So I get that done. And then when that's great, actually end of March will be good because I'm traveling to, after I wrap Bosch, my last episode, we're traveling to Aberdeen, Scotland, where we're going to do a screening and then we're shooting at Slane's Castle and stuff. So I'll be back by the end of March, which means I can help promote it on all my social media.
Awesome.
Well.
Okay. That works out great then. Perfect. Julietta, thank you. And down the road, we'll have to do this again. Maybe we'll get Armin involved too and do a little
roundtable. Oh my gosh. Roundtable. And by the way, have you interviewed Harry Groener at all?
Yes. I love Harry.
Harry's amazing. He's also a dear friend, he and Dawn. And they actually play, Harry and Dawn, his wife, do the voiceover of the parents in our film. And they're just brilliant. Like it was so much fun to work with them. But yeah, Harry, maybe we could do one with Harry Armin. We can all hang out.
Yeah, that'll be great. We can definitely get that together. I talked to Armin and Harry right about the same time last year.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was funny because I almost asked you that earlier when you were talking about Armin because they belong to the same theater company.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was so awesome when we recorded the parents with Harry and Dawn. They came over to our house. They live right around the block, so we see them all the time. And we thought we were just going to do it as a temp kind of thing to lay in later. But they were so good that we ended up mixing on the Sony lot. And when we went in and we were like, is this usable? Can we use it? And we ended up using it because they just got every ounce of every thing and every intonation and there's a layering of the voiceover of the parents and stuff. And it was just, I felt like we could, it was like, why do it again? You guys just hit out of the ballpark right away. So
that is great. I would love to get all three of you down the road. We'll have to work that out amongst your schedules when we can get to it.
All right. Perfect. Well, have a great night and thank you so much. And we will talk soon.
All right, Juliet. Have a great rest of your night.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, folks, that's a wrap. I hope you enjoyed that chat with Juliet. As always, thanks for listening, and we'll see you back next time.
Monsters, madness, and magic.